So just before we get into this episode, I would like to announce something very exciting, and that is that Pause Trading are now sponsoring this podcast. So that is alongside Naylor Agility Tunnels, and I honestly can't tell you how excited I am by this. I have been a huge fan of Pause Trading products since the very start of me doing agility. If you're from the UK, you will probably know who they are already, because they are at majority of our shows, very present, and especially for me in the north, I see them almost every show. But Pause Trading is a brilliant family-run business. They have every product known to mankind that you might need for your dog training and dog care needs. So whether it's a road refresher ball, long-lasting chews, toys that are made specific for agility, you name it, they have it. And I can't explain to you how excited I am to be working with these guys. I have just received my first package from them, so I will be reviewing them as I go, and their products, which, as you already know, I'm probably going to be a huge fan of anyways. But the first products I've received are the Blue Pink Pig vet bedding and Paws Made Chaser toys, and that has the cutest design with a little pig on. And I've also received amazing treats. I've got their fish and poultry training treats, and we have some pate, which is going to go down so well with my guys, and the ball cubes as well. So I'm really excited to test those out. If you're interested in finding out more, you can always message me or catch me at a show. But yeah, without further ado, we'll get into this episode. And of course, as well, thank you to Naylor Agility for sponsoring this podcast too. They've just released their new non-slip plus agility tunnels, so definitely get in touch if you'd like to hear more. But without further ado, we'll get into it. Hi everyone, and today we've got Hayley Lakes with me to talk about distance handling, so I'm very excited. So Hayley, could you introduce yourself for anyone that isn't aware of who you are? Introduce your dogs. I think we might be here a while though if we're going to go through all of your dogs. How long you've been in agility for, and what's been your favourite achievement to date?
Hi Luce, thanks for having me on. Wow, okay, lots of questions to start with. Yeah, I won't run through all the dogs. So obviously we have a lot of dogs, lots of different breeds. I started with a collie, but I've also run flatties, kelpies, spaniels, a husky, an old English, crossbreeds. That probably covers most of it.
Yeah, and your Dalmatian too.
Oh, yes, of course, my Dalmatian. He's a baby. He's just starting out now. He's only baby. But yeah, so I do like to work with a range of different breeds. I always think different dogs teach us so many different things, and even dogs in the same breed can be so different. So yeah we have a lot of different dogs. They span a range of agility grades. I've had two in grade 7. Most of mine have hit grade 5, but most of our big dogs, I only compete them for 2 years. So the flatties, they only compete for 2 years and then they retire, and they just enjoy life as luxury at home.
Oh, I didn't realize that. That's really nice. Bless them.
Well, they're big dogs. They're not designed to jump constantly like the collies and that. So my first agility dog was born at the end of 2011. Mm-hmm. So I didn't actually start agility until 2012. So I've really only been in the game 10-11 years.
Wow.
I qualified as an instructor back in 2008. In 2009, but I didn't actually have a dog to do agility with until 2011. So yeah, I've not actually been in the game as long as a lot of people seem to think I have been.
Wow. Yeah, no, I'm like I say, I'm just as fine. I mean, in that short space of time though, you fit a lot of things in there, I must say.
Yeah, we have a lot of dogs, it makes it easy.
Awesome. So in terms of achievements, what's been your favourite one so far?
Okay, I don't think I have a specific achievement that stands out for me more than anything. Probably one of my favourite runs I ever did was, actually it wasn't even at Kennel Club, it was at BAC back in 2018.
Oh, yeah.
And it was with my Kelpie, and Neil Ellis was judging, and it was the first run of the weekend on the Saturday morning. And we got halfway around this course and I flicked him out on the other side of the dog walk and didn't cross the dog walk because I could still run a bit back then. Mm-hmm. And the whole room just went quiet whilst we layered like half the ring. And we nailed it and we actually won the class.
Wow. So
that's one of my favorites, like the first time we ever did anything big like that.
Wow. I mean, that's incredible. And plus on a Neil course, to do it at distance, that is insane as well. So congratulations to that. Yeah. That is an achievement in itself. Awesome. So we have some really good questions today, actually. I'm very excited. And I'm excited for my personal experience as well. I love to learn about distance handling. So, yeah, so we'll get into the first one if you're happy to.
Yeah, let's go for it.
Awesome. Okay. So for anyone that's listening who might be aware, could you just tell us what distance handling is and is it for everyone and every dog?
Okay. Distance handling. Everyone will have their own opinion on what distance handling is. Mm-hmm. So there isn't a set definition of distance handling. Mm-hmm. So I can only tell you what I consider it to be. So I consider distance handling to be the dog performing skills and obstacles away from the handler. Mm-hmm. Typically meaning there's going to be other obstacles in between the handler and where the dog is working. So the dog is working a significant distance away from the handler, but it's not just straight lines and driving. When I'm teaching, I break distance down into three different categories, or I can break agility into four categories.
Yeah.
So you've got full distance, which is basically what I do. It's mostly standing still with a bit of walking, or being fairly central to the course and the dog does most of the work. You've got semi-distance, which is where you may walk or you may run, but mm-hmm. you're not with the dog. So you send the dog in one direction and you travel across the ring in another direction, meet the dog to do something difficult, then you send the dog off that way and then you travel a different way and you meet the dog and you do the next difficult thing. So that's what I call semi-distance.
Yeah.
Independence tends to be where we still run around with our dogs, but typically the handler won't keep up with the dog. So the dog is expected to work one or two obstacles away, but not really any further away than one or two jumps. And then you've got the runners. So those are my four categories that I split agility into.
Interesting.
Is it for everyone and their dog? Anyone can do distance handling if they want to. It's achievable for pretty much anyone, whether you run, walk, or sit down. My particular system works off verbal cues, so it wouldn't be completely suitable for a non-verbal handler, but many elements of it would still be used in the training side. We just wouldn't transition them onto verbal cue. So, I think anyone can do distance if they really want to.
Yeah, and I like what you say there about the verbal cues there, because I think that that's something that sometimes gets a bit forgotten about, especially because I'm sort of, from my perspective, I do a lot of the running with my dogs and keeping up with them. So sometimes I find they rely on my body language a lot. And as you say, you know, using your verbal cues and making them strong enough and using your system can be really beneficial. And I think that's something I probably need to work on, because although I must admit, my verbals sometimes aren't the clearest to my dogs. I do the odd tunnel when I mean weave and whatnot. I don't know if you had that.
Yes, actually. There's a quite entertaining video somewhere on social media when I did with the Kelpie, gave the wrong word. His verbals were very good. So he literally stopped dead and went, "Well, you said that. Hang on. There it is, Mom. It's on the side of the ring. I got this." And he shot off across the ring to go and find what I told him to do.
Oh, bless him. What a good dog.
Yeah, good dog. Unfortunately, having good verbals sometimes does mean it actually works against us. If I say the wrong thing and my dog actually does what I've told them, they might too. Yeah, it goes very wrong very fast.
Oh, bless him. amazing. Okay, so next question. At what point do you introduce distance handling into your young dog's training? And if this is dog dependent, what factors would you say influence when you would start this?
Okay. So to be honest, for my dogs, for my students' dogs, distance handling is just how we train from day dot. In some ways, our foundations will be very similar to traditional handlers, but in other ways, it'll actually be completely the opposite. So regarding age, we'll work on similar lines to what most agility people will work on. So we work with just a wing or with puppy bumps if the dogs are less than a year old. Breed dependent for me you have to be careful of physical demands, because obviously different breeds mature at different rates. So a Spaniel or a Terrier is physically more mature, younger than, say, a Dalmatian or a Flatty. Their bodies mature differently. But also mental health. So even dogs within the same breed can mature mentally at different rates. So for me, yes, I'll introduce it from day dot, but what I do with that dog will depend on the dog's mental and physical capabilities. I don't see the point in overfacing a dog with too much just because they can. Saying that, most of our training is very, very simple and easy to understand for both dogs and handlers. So they still have to be dog dependent. So if we take a high drive, high energy dog, typically that means that they will cope with a little bit more, so a few more repetitions, than a lower energy dog right at the start. But it's confidence and understanding that you want to go for. So I don't typically do a lot of very technical things when they're young. I don't do hugely technical foundations. Everything is very, very simple, and it works off the dog being very, very confident and their ability to understand what we're doing more than their age or their breed to influence it.
Interesting. Yeah, no, I definitely agree that I think it's a really important thing to kind of look after the dog's motivation and their confidence. So it's nice to hear that, like, with the distance handling, you would go at the dog's pace. And sometimes I guess people can kind of ask of too much too soon, and I'm guessing that's where it can sometimes crumble a little bit with certain dogs.
Very much so. I think one of the most common things with distance is people are in a rush to get the dog 5 miles away. Mm-hmm. And actually, that's the worst thing you can do. You know, your dog's got to be happy and comfortable doing the different things that you need them to do. And they've got to want to do them before you even try and ask them to do it 2 meters away. Mm-hmm. And most people seem to be in a rush to end up meters and meters and meters from their dog, when actually that's really the worst thing you can do. They've got to know what they're doing before they get far away from you.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, I always like to think of, I always kind of watched Dawn Weaver's stuff, and I know she had the knowledgeable speed sort of mindset with her dogs, and I definitely think it's true, because you just find as soon as they understand something, you can ask for more of it, but it's because they've got that knowledge there, if that makes sense. And that actually brings on quite nicely to the next question. So I don't know if you've got anything else to add to that point there, but what are the most common mistakes you see people make when beginning to teach distance work? Is that, would you say that covers it, or is there anything else you would sort of add to that?
So I think that's the main one, is people tending to rush to add the distance too fast. So look, as weird as it sounds, almost all of my training is done in the back garden. Okay. So I don't have anywhere to train. I haven't had anywhere to train in 4 years. My dogs only see most equipment at shows.
Really?
And we have a small garden. So if I want competition spacing, we're talking 3 jumps. If I don't want competition spacing, I can just about squeeze 5 jumps in. So you don't need to work on your dog being miles away from you. It's far more important that you work on the value in the jumps, the confidence of the dog, and the understanding of the different skills.
Wow.
The other thing that I will say, and I'm sure there'll be lots of people that hate me for this, but I'm going to say it anyway because it's me. I see a lot of people that go off and do puppy camps.
Mm-hmm.
And most people, I think that's a fantastic thing to do. I'm not going to diss puppy camps. I think they're a great idea. Predominantly, the videos I see after puppy camps are the handler or the trainer running up and down, dragging a toy in, the puppy chasing you.
Mm-hmm.
If you want distance, don't do that, because the last thing you want your dog to do is to learn to chase after you or to chase after someone. So it's not something any of my dogs have ever done, or my students' dogs. All you're really doing, don't get me wrong, for runners where you're ahead of the dog and the dog is learning to chase you and you send them off into a skill and you run off and the dogs catch up, it's a fantastic thing to teach. I'm not knocking the teaching of it, but not if you want distance. You don't want your dog to run you down and learn to only drive when they're chasing you. It's more important that they drive away from you and off their own independent thought than because you're running up and down.
Interesting. Do you know what? Now you've said that, that makes a lot of sense, actually. And I guess it's something, as you say, it's quite commonly done. But if you're wanting to teach distance skills purely to the level that you do, it makes a lot of sense, actually. Yeah, I know. I can definitely see the benefits there. And I'm just thinking now for my next ones, if I'm not going to be quite as quick as them, it's probably going to work in my benefit to teach them to not chase me. I wish I'd done that with my dog sooner, actually.
Yeah, I mean, you know, don't get me wrong, it's a fantastic thing to do if you are able to run. And it means that you get out there on an agility course and you have a little bit more to rely on, because you know the first thing you want to do is chase you, and you know it's going to chase you. So it does give you a bit of a bonus there if you can do it. Mm-hmm. But even if you do that, I think it's good to do some other things as well, so you're not just relying on the dog's ability to chase you.
Yeah, absolutely. No, that's a really good point. Yeah, I'm definitely going to be adapting my puppy training, I think, going forward, to just to add that little bit more distance work and reduce that chasiness maybe. That's, yeah, fantastic. Thank you. Question four. So I guess this is actually leading quite nicely. So what's the best way to reinforce a dog for distance handling? And do you have any advice for the people who train on their own?
Okay. So I always train on my own, unless I get to a workshop or something. So I feel you is the first thing I'm going to say. Second thing I'm going to say is teach yourself how to throw.
Yeah.
And then I'm going to swear, so nobody slag me off for this. Buy a ball chucker. So the paws pockets from Paws Trading fit in a ball chucker.
Wow.
They are so much easier to throw over a long distance if you can use a ball chucker. Now, I'm going to hold my hands up. I'm not advocating using a ball chucker to exercise your dog, but when you train on your own, sometimes you need something to help you reward your dog away from you. So a ball chucker can be really handy for getting in the toy a little bit further away if your throwing is as bad as mine is.
Wow. Yeah, that's a really good point. And that's quite interesting about the pause training pockets fitting into those as well. I really like that idea. You go ahead.
That's what I was going to say. I know Paws Trading do them with a rubber ball on the bottom as well, and a handle, so you can really swing them and give them a good chuck. They're brilliant as well. But yeah, ball chuckers. Who knew?
I know. Who knew? Do you know what? I always learned something interesting. I can't remember which podcast it was, but there was another one where I thought, yeah, I would never have thought in a million years to use that. But actually, you know what? I'm going to start using it. Awesome. So
I will add, while we're on the subject of rewarding, I know the question is based on what I would do, but I can't not say this. I'm also going to tell you what I wouldn't do.
Yeah.
So I wouldn't reward from the hand unless I'm teaching something very specific. Mm-hmm. I also don't use dead toys, targets, or treat machines, manners, minders, treat and trains. I hate them.
Oh.
Okay. All of those things will teach your dog to drive to something.
Yeah.
Then you have to do all that work to teach the dog. Basically, you're going to teach the dog that you lied to them, and now you're going to take away what they're running to, and then you still need to teach the dog the end behavior.
Yeah.
So honestly, if you want to do a decent amount of distance, even if it's just semi-distance, dead toys, targets, treat machines, stay away from them. They will not help you.
Interesting. Yeah, I can definitely see your point there, actually. Like you say, with them driving towards something, it's not going to give you that, unless it's the equipment, as you say, when you put the value into the equipment and that's what they drive to. But I guess the reward side of it is... It's difficult to phase out, isn't it?
Yeah, it can be. And the problem is the dog becomes very reliant. So I've had students come to workshops and things, and they're like, oh, I've had an injury. I've started doing a bit of not running, and I put the manners minder down the bottom of the garden, and he's amazing. And then my question will always be, and what happens when you take the manners minder away? Oh, well, he can't do it then. Ah. Kind of answer your own question with that. Yeah. Don't get me wrong, they have their place in training, I'm sure they do, but when it comes to teaching the distance, you're just teaching your dog to run to a machine or a dead toy or whatever.
And like you say, it when you take that away, it probably shows the kind of the lack of independence there, I'm guessing.
It does. The dogs just learn to rely on the tools that we use. So the less tools that you can use, the more realistic your training will be. So if you always rely on five different tools, then until you've faded all five of those tools, mm-hmm. you're going to have an unreliable trained dog in the ring without the tools.
Mm, yeah, no, definitely. And that actually leads us quite nicely onto the next question. You're doing amazing leading us into the next ones. The next one, this person asks, how would you adapt your training for clingier types of dogs compared to independent naturally independent dogs, I assume? And also, does the size of your dog change the way you train distance with them?
Okay. Okay, so clingier dogs.
Yeah.
These guys, they need much more in the foundation. You need to take your time and you need to pay super high wages. Don't be skimping on those rewards. The higher the wages, the stronger the end behavior. With dogs that are naturally more independent, yeah, okay, they can make your life easier in some ways, but then in other ways, they will be just as challenging, if not more challenging. Mm-hmm. An independent dog's very easy to get to work away from you, yeah. but if they're that independent, you still need them to listen to you. Whereas a dog that's clingy is going to be more likely to listen, and you just have to work on their confidence working away more. So there is pros and cons. I've worked with, if I just talk about my own dogs rather than students' dogs, we have a wide variety of dogs in this house. Mm-hmm. And my base system trains every single dog exactly the same, just the base system. Then it gets adapted for different dogs and different handlers based on what they need. So for example, my husky, he was a complete Velcro dog when he started agility. Mm-hmm. I could still run back then, so it didn't matter. But I had to be close enough to the jump to touch the wing of the jump if I wanted him to take the jump. All right.
Okay.
He was very lazy. He was the easiest dog in the world to train because he was so food motivated, but he was very lazy. The only time he was particularly good was he loved to compete at champ shows where there was 400 or 500 dogs in the class, and he thought everyone was there just to look at him. Aww. He was a baby. So he did later have to transition across to distance handling, and he did do it very successfully, working rings at semi-distance with me walking around the middle of the ring and directing him. But he had to have a lot of work done in the foundation stages, even though he was already grade four at that time. Mm-hmm. And so with a couple of years, and he successfully competed at grade five. But again, I retired the bigger dogs very young. I don't really run them for many years. Whereas if we then look at Atom, Atom's my Kelpie. Atom's the dog that most people kind of recognised me for when I first started to be known for distance. When I stopped running with him and I transitioned to full distance, he literally sat there and cheered. He was like, blimey, mum, it's about blooming time you get on with my job. I got this. And he was like the opposite end of the scale. He was much happier just being left to work, because it was like, it was almost like a trust thing. Him knowing that I was trusting him to do it meant he worked much better than when I was with him. Mm. So different dogs. Now, both of those dogs, I mean, Atom was never Velcro, but Nova was very Velcro. Mm-hmm. Both of them started with me running and both of them transitioned to proper distance. And it's just putting the time in the area that dog needs. Mm. The size of dog, pretty sure this has absolutely no bearing on how we train distance. Oh. I've worked with all breeds. And I think it's the personality that's important. The influencing factor is the personality of the dog you want to work with. So whether it's, so I'm just going to reel off some breeds now. Yeah. Papillons, Chinese Crested, Dachshunds, general crossbreeds, Beagles, Terriers, Spaniels, Mazzies, Tollers, Collies, Kelpies, Gundogs, Setters, Great Danes, Sholos, Lurchers, Huskies, Dalmatians, and the Old English. You name it, I've probably worked with that breed or crossbreed. And I've probably worked with more than one of that breed or crossbreed.
Yeah.
And it is not the breed that affects it. I know some Papillons that are drivier than Collies.
Really?
I know some Collies that are the most laid-back thing in the world. Yeah, my husky was incredible for a husky. Everyone kept telling me huskies, they run off and kill things and they have no recall. Well, he taught himself to walk nicely on a lead. He was awful working in harness and he had a better recall than my collie. So it really isn't the breed, it's the individual dog. Yeah. And I'm a huge fan of not being breedist. It's why we have so many different breeds. They teach us all so many things. And interestingly enough, we actually had our two collies, half brother and sister, and they were Chalk and Cheese. He was off his rocker, and she's a lady of leisure.
Oh.
And you're like, you couldn't get more different. And they were half brother and sister, and they were raised the same way and everything. So I don't think size or breed really has any bearing. I think it really is individual personality of the dog you're working with. They're either drivey or they're not, and that depends on how much work you've got to put in.
Mm-hmm. Interesting. And I think that's really nice, actually, looking at and working with a dog in front of you, because I guess it's probably very easy to compare and make assumptions and label. As you say, you know, your husky people came up to you and you know, presumed differently of him, but as you say, you just trained a dog that was in front of you, and I'm very similar. I quite like to have different breeds, because as you said as well, you learn so much from different ones. It's unbelievable.
It is. They are just dogs. Dogs are just fascinating. God, I could spend my whole life studying them. They're incredible animals.
Oh, me too. I could geek out on dog behavior all day, but we will be here about 12 hours if we do that.
Yeah.
Amazing. So, next question. This is a really interesting one, actually, and I guess it goes back to one of your first dogs. So, any advice for training distance discrimination with a fast dog? And this person also specifies that their dog gets easily frustrated and relies on their body language over verbals. So I know you've had a lot of experience with very, very quick dogs. So anything to advise for that one?
Okay. Firstly, if you can't be there, you really need to proof your cues. And I know that people hate proofing things because it's boring. But you know what? Proofing is the way to go. Yeah. So we play a game. It's what I do with my students. I challenge them to a game of Be More Colin. So I appreciate that. Probably doesn't mean a lot unless you've either read my book or you're in my online training. So we have like a little artist's poseable mannequin. I can pose his arms, I can pose his legs. And when we're doing theory, whether we're on camps or whatever, this is Colin. My poseable little dude is Colin. And we train our exercises as we would normally. So we train it on the right, we train it on the left, but we're always in the middle of the sequence. It's where you'd always choose to be. Mm-hmm. Colin doesn't handle it from the middle of the sequence. No, no, no. Colin will handle it from 3 o'clock, 6 o'clock, 9 o'clock and 12 o'clock on the outside. So whilst technically all that's doing is proofing the cues, what I'm actually doing is challenging you to stand outside your comfort zone, handle it from outside around the clock, play Be More Colin, and that will proof every cue. So for example, if you take a really simple wing wrap cue, right? Mm-hmm. What does our wing wrap cue mean?
I think sometimes it's very person dependent. I know for mine, it means wrap and come back towards me. So I don't know if that's very beneficial for distance training.
and that's, but you see, that's the answer I normally get. Yeah. So this is where I would say, you know what, if you want to do distance, firstly, don't be selfish. Stop thinking about you, think about the dog. Mm. So secondly, that means that your wing wrap cue has to be relevant to your dog,
yeah,
and to the equipment. It shouldn't necessarily be relevant to you.
Interesting.
It may be directionally relevant to you, as in you have wrap towards and wrap away, mm-hmm, or you have a right wrap and a left wrap. So if we take that wing wrap cue, so for my dogs, in theory, the cue means take the jump that you're approaching, take it in deceleration, turning tightly, going over the pole and around the wing in whatever direction you've been told to do it.
Yeah.
So then if we now picture that jump in front of us and we stand, let's say we've got our dog on our left-hand side, we're facing the jump and we give our left wrap cue, we would expect the dog to wrap to the left away from us and be rewarded. So then if the dog starts in the same position and the handler works around the clock, so if the starting point was, say, the 6 o'clock of a clock, mm-hmm, then 3 o'clock, the handler would be alongside the right-hand side of that jump wing, but the dog's still got a wrap left.
Yeah.
And then you continue it. So the one that most people don't do is stand at 12 o'clock directly facing their dog and their dog's got to jump towards them and wrap away from them. Now, because my wing wrap cue means wrap tight left on that jump, whereas your wing wrap cue means wrap and come to you, your dog would probably go straight over the jump and come to you. My dog would perform the wrap regardless of the position I was in.
Interesting. Yeah. And I can definitely see the benefits with that one. 100%. Now you've said it about the perspective of from the dog's point of view rather than my point of view. It makes it a lot clearer, actually, what I'm asking the dogs. I'm not asking them of the behaviour. I'm actually asking them to look towards me all the time. So, yeah, I can definitely see how in my training, how I've adapted it differently to how you would do it for distance, which is fascinating.
It's wing wraps. I won't get totally into the training side of things, but wing wraps and round the backs, I have the most fascinating conversations on workshops with people. And I don't necessarily change anything that they know. I change their perspective. Mm-hmm. All right. So your dog has got to be able to prove every cue from around that clock, every entry, every exit with you at every hour of the clock. And then if you really want to proof this, going back to the original question of proofing it, you then want to add in an off-course obstacle in front, behind, alongside, etc., and keep ensuring that your dog's success rate is super high. So if you ask for a wrap left on a jump wing, put a tunnel there, put a dog walk there, put a weave there, put another jump, put a jump to the left, and the dog's got to wrap, not turn left. And it's all one jump exercises, two jump exercises. But until the understanding is there of that cue in any situation, then typically, unless you're there to support the dog with your body and physically show them what you want, the dog's not going to be able to do it when you're not there.
I'm soaking all this up, by the way. I'm thinking, God, what can I go do with my training now? And I really like how you touched on earlier as well about how all of your training's done with just garden exercises, with just, you know, three or four, five jumps. I find that fascinating how you know, as you say, the proof is in the pudding, if we like. When you are, you know, working on those behaviours around a variety of things, and you don't necessarily need a huge field, as long as you're proofing the behaviour, it clearly shows how your distance can be fantastic without even having to have that space in the first place.
Yeah, absolutely. Most people are quite shocked when I say, well, actually, my dogs only see kit at shows, a couple of jumps in the garden.
I'm fascinated by that.
I can fit two planks of the dog walk in the garden. If I have all three planks of the dog walk, then they end up in the hedge. So we have to just do the top and the down plank. But again, you don't need masses of space. There is one other thing that I want to talk on while we're talking about this particular lady's question. And that is arousal training. So I work my dogs initially. They're always very, very calm. I don't wind dogs up. I can't stand dogs being over aroused and wound up. I don't think it's good for their mental health. Mm-hmm. But at agility shows, we see a lot of over aroused dogs barking, bouncing, lunging around the rings, etc. So we also need to teach our dogs how to think in a heightened state of arousal. So I actually think more dogs do understand their verbal cues than people realize, but in that environment, because I bet they'd also, well, he does it at training, he does it at home. But in the competition environment, the dog can't do it. So I have a whole section in my online training that is literally devoted to thinking through arousal, and it's the dogs being, obviously, we start them very calm and we add in more and more and more arousal to the point that we could be jumping up and down, screaming and shouting, ready, 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 and whooping and making all kinds of noises. And the dog is then asked to perform something really mundane, like a sit, in the middle of running around like a lunatic. But we build up to that. And I think as long as you teach the dog how to be able to still access the right brain cells in a heightened state of arousal, half the time that's actually the problem, and most people don't realize that that's what their dog needs to work on. It's not actually agility training that their dog needs.
Fascinating. And yeah, I couldn't agree more, actually. Coming from sort of a more behavioral background, I can appreciate how that arousal can just prevent them from actually being able to think at all, really. I mean, I guess it's like us. I mean, if I, you know, going into a an exam at school when you're younger, you're not thinking the same way you would afterwards, because you're in that state of, you know, stress and all of that. So it does make absolute sense for our dogs who haven't really got the capacity to understand it, why they would struggle.
Yeah, it's, I mean, like you say, coming from the behavioural point of view, I did behavioural stuff for many years before I got into sports. So you totally get it. It's, why would we try and ask our dog to work in that state of mind? If they can't work in a calm state of mind, you've got no chance when they're highly aroused. But you've got to teach them how to cope with the highly aroused state, because it's what we encounter at shows.
Absolutely. This next question, I'm really excited to see your perspective on, actually, because I think for myself it would be very beneficial to know. So what advice could you give to judges when course designing and with planning judges' paths that would help those who rely on distance handling?
Okay, so this is quite a big question, and there's it's going to be quite a long answer. I will try not to go off on many tangents here. So let's break it down. Designing the course. So firstly, you've got to think about the dog's path first and foremost. So you design your course and you pick basically the route that you expect the dog to take.
Yeah.
Then you've got to expect that a distance handler is going to make different choices to a running handler, as they're not there to manage a situation up close. So an example of this would be, if we have a jump that requires a turn to the next obstacle, and turning left is the shortest distance, i.e. a wing wrap, and that's the way all the runners would handle it. So it turns the dog into the handler, because most people aren't as good at rear crosses. So the wing wrap would be towards the handler. It's the shortest distance, but turning left and doing that wrap may present your dog with 3, 4 or potentially 5 alternative follow-on obstacles because of where a distance handler might be. So if you're there to handle a wing wrap, then you practically block the off courses. The dog comes inside your body and bingo, they're on to the next one.
Yeah.
With a distance handler, turning left could present 3 or 4 or 5 or more obstacles that the dog could potentially see and go, well, which one do you want? So then if we consider, okay, well, if the dog was to turn right over the jump, yeah, it might be a longer distance. It might still potentially be faster if it's a slice over a wrap.
Yeah.
But it might also mean that the next obstacle is now not on a good line. But our dog is potentially presented with only the correct obstacle or one alternative instead of 4 or 5 alternatives. So it reduces the options to the dog turning right over turning left in a particular incident. So that then brings me on to contacts, because judging at the moment, there's a huge amount of discussion about contacts and safety and speed. And I think it's great that we're having discussion. But this is where I will be controversial. It's me, I'm allowed to be. So we see a lot of deliberately laid course design that forces a turn in a specific direction to put the dog onto a contact. So it's very specifically set. They're assuming the handlers are on the inside of a circle. The dog's coming around and they expect the dog to wrap to the handler and go up a contact. Mm-hmm. But without the handler there, it's not impossible to do the same line, but it is more difficult to send the dog the same way as the runners do and get the nicer line. So what my request would be is, when you're course designing, have jumps at a more neutral angle that's allowing a dog and a handler to opt to go left or right without forcing a dire line onto contacts. Now, personally, I teach my dogs horrible contact entries, and I mean very horrible contact entries, because I know that they are going to see them, whether it's down to course design or whether it's down to, you know what, it really doesn't work for me when I'm all the way over on the right hand side to turn my dog the wrong way on a jump, when the natural line or the slice line, the better line for the dog, is to slice instead of wrap, and then they've got to go on at a dodgy angle onto a contact. So I am controversial there, because I will train my dogs the most horrendous angles onto contacts. Obviously, I build it up gradually. I make sure they're safe as I do it, and it's all done at slower speed. But I do think it's important. So I think judges, think about when you're setting a jump onto a contact that's off a turn, actually, I'm the annoying person in your class that's not going to take that line. I'm going to turn the other way. So set your jumps at a bit more of a neutral angle to allow handlers to choose whether they go left or right. So I think that's a big one. But I appreciate course design is tricky. And I will hold my hand up and say I am actually a fully qualified KC judge since 2012. I don't judge nowadays, but that's only because my health, I can't stand and judge for hours on end. I miss judging and I love judging. So I've got a lot of time for judges, and I'm not going to sit here and diss judges, but it is one of my things that I will bring up is neutral angles for dogs.
Yeah.
I think if we talk,
I'm sorry.
Oh, no, go on, go for it.
I definitely agree what you're saying there. I remember when I did my training course, my instructor, she said, you know, when you're setting your contacts, you've always got to be mindful. There will be that one person that will take that other line. So make sure whichever line they're going to take is going to be safe, not just the one that you intend. So I think that's a really good point, again, to just bring to the table for judges, you know, making sure that, yes, okay, one angle's good, but as you said, what about that other one that 9 times out of 10 that no one will take, but there will always be one person that might.
Yeah, and annoyingly, that person will 9 times out of 10 be me.
And let's say sometimes you haven't got the choice with you know, in terms of the abilities to get that, and you know, for other distance handlers, it's physically impossible to be able to turn the dogs a certain way because of where the position is and the way the course layout is. What would you say about sometimes we see weave entries onto dog walks or tunnel entries onto dog walks? Is that beneficial in a way for people with distance, or does that pose its own problems?
For me personally, it doesn't really bother me. Mm-hmm. Dogs have a set exit point with a tunnel, they have a set exit point with a weave.
Yeah.
So in some ways it will make the line more specific for a dog and handler because it's not relying on a dog turning tightly, turning loosely, turning a specific way. Mm-hmm. Saying that, I know a lot of people struggle with things like tunnel to dog walk because their dog can't see them for the 1 second it's in a tunnel. And as the dog comes out, they look for the handler, at which point they can then be on a dodgy line onto the contacts. So I think there's pros and cons to both. I mean, I love having other things onto contacts instead of it always being jumps.
Yeah.
But I'm also surprisingly actually very not fussy. As long as the angle allows for the dog to pass either side of the jump, it doesn't really bother me what equipment goes. And of course, if we then talk agility,
yeah,
agility is harder than jumping typically for distances. Just because the big equipment comes into the ring and it's typically placed across the middle of the ring or across an angle. So part of the ring is blocked off. I'm not moaning. I love this kind of challenge because I will walk the course on the right side of the dog walk and I'll walk the course on the left side of the dog walk. And then I'll make a decision which one I'm going to go for. Because I typically, personally, I can't always get round a dog walk. Mm. So I have to work the course from half the ring. Now, I love that. That is such a challenge. It makes it blooming hard, but I love the challenge of it. Whereas other people, I mean, it does make me go, don't get me wrong, I love seeing the runners doing their thing and some of the brilliant runners and handlers, dog pairings out there, they're fabulous to watch. But it does make me chuckle when they make it by the skin of their teeth around the dog walk to get to the other side. And I'm like, you know what? I'm not even going to consider going around that dog walk. It does make me chuckle, but it does make course design harder for the judges. So going back to the judging thing, obviously, firstly, you've got to design a good course.
Yeah.
Secondly, you've got to make sure you can judge the course. So that's why I gave up judging, because with my health deteriorating, I know I wouldn't be able to judge to the high standard that I hold myself to. And anyone who is a student of mine or who's ever trained with me knows my standards are ridiculously high for my students, for myself. And I think if I can't do the job right, then I shouldn't be doing it. So I always urge judges, don't get me wrong, I used to love judging and I do miss it. But sometimes there is a time to retire from judging if you are no longer up to judging at a high standard. I'm not thinking of anyone specifically at all here. I'm just, that's me, that's my opinion and how I dealt with me. So with the judging in mind, you've then got to decide on your route through and around the course. Now, obviously, you'll have an expected path in mind for the dog and the handler.
Yeah.
Always consider contingencies there. So if you're planning that the majority of the course will run with the handler on one side, always have the contingency. What if the handler comes this side of the obstacle? What if the dog gets sent to the left instead of the right? Am I, as a judge, close enough to be in their way? Am I going to become another obstacle for the dog and handler? Mm. That's a great story. sorry. We had a course at a champ show back in 2022. I was the opposite side of the contacts to everybody else. And the judge ended up trying to stay out of my path. And then, because he tried so hard to get out of my way, he was on the other side of the contacts to where he'd been for the others. And he got in my dog's path. And in that moment, the judge froze. And that was the perfect thing to do because my dog, as soon as the judge froze, obviously he was totally in my dog's way, but I get why, you know, it wasn't a mistake. He was trying to stay out of my way. And so he froze and my dog wrapped around him and carried on with the course. It literally got on video, little Pixel, he just wrapped around the judge's legs, picked up the tunnel and he was off. And he got quite a few giggles around the ring. And it's not the first time I've had dogs bomb round a judge. It's not a diss. The judge did absolutely the right thing. If he'd kept moving and trying to help by dodging my dog would have probably been more distracted by someone dancing around in front of them, going forwards, backwards, left, right, going, which way do you want to go? By freezing, it allowed my dog to just get on with it. You know, so it's interesting. So then we get on to judges' movement, which I don't always think judges realise the impact they have on a dog in a ring. Now, they impact all dogs, whether their handlers are running, walking, sitting, whatever. But you then have to appreciate in a split second. So, for example, if a dog goes into a tunnel, the last thing the dog sees before it goes into a tunnel is what it's going to expect when it comes out of the tunnel. For example, if the handler is charging at the tunnel at full speed, the dog is expecting to come out of the tunnel driving hard and fast forwards. If, as the dog is entering the tunnel, the handler physically uses the deceleration of their own body, the dog will expect to come out of the tunnel decelerating, looking for the handler, looking for the next obstacle. And that's no different with a distance dog, except our legs aren't often the nearest pair of legs. So when you're judging and you're moving around the course, you have some judges that run everywhere, all over the ring. So I'm going to pick on Neil here, Neil Ellis. You know, he's known for running all around the ring. Not having a dig, I love Neil. I get on very well with Neil. He's a fabulous guy. He's one of the best judges we've got. And I never have an issue with his judging. And he runs all over the place, but he's consistent. So my dogs walk in the ring and right at the start, they realise the judge is running around and they just accept that that's what the judge is doing. And because it's consistent, it's fine. So then you have another judge. You have a judge who stands very, very still. They've designed their course so that they don't need to do a huge amount of movement. They're probably not as young and as fit as Nick. And they are stood very, very still. Again, most dogs aren't going to bat an eyelid at them. They're not really moving, a little bit of movement here and there, but they're not moving enough to be a potential draw for the dog.
Yeah.
So then you've got the judge who does a bit of both. They stand still, then they suddenly accelerate and stop and run and stop and run and stop. And that is very interesting to watch, even with runners. So the dogs, they suddenly, in their peripheral vision usually, have a pair of legs running at them. And dogs will accelerate in that direction in that millisecond, even with a runner with them. So it's much harder with a distance handler because our pair of legs is not necessarily the nearest pair of legs. So I think it's important, you know, my request here would be consistent. So pick a pace to travel around your course and then stay at it. Try not to suddenly run, suddenly stop. So if you can moderate your speed to be consistent, it becomes easier for the dog to pick out their handler because they know where the handler is. They're aware that you're running around like a crazy person, or they're aware that you're moving, but you're being consistent and they can pay attention to that. So distance handlers are very used to layering judges. Our dogs are used to layering judges. Hell, one of the things that we train is having other people in the course between us and our dog, because we have to.
Yeah.
But we can't take into account erratic movement. So let's talk about layering of judges. Scunthorpe earlier this year, there was a lovely, lovely low grade jumping course being judged by Amanda Luttman. Lovely woman, really, really great course design. And it just worked, this course did. So I stayed right back near the start line. I don't think I actually passed jump number two.
Wow.
She was judging from the middle of the ring on the other side of the weaves. The weaves were kind of diagonally up the centre of the ring. And she said afterwards it was quite weird to hear me behind her. She could hear me giving all the verbal cues and she could see the dog in front of her. But obviously she couldn't see me. And she said it was quite weird being able to hear like me directing, but not be able to see me and have the dog going left and right and turning round. But again, you know, she'd picked her spot for judging. We knew where she was. She doesn't run around. She didn't need to for that course. She moved, yes, but she was very smooth with her movement. And this was with my young dog. And he didn't bat an eyelid at her. And it's quite interesting. So I have had dogs where we've had a judge move very suddenly. And in that split second, my dogs have seen that movement in their peripheral and they've been pulled in that direction. And then 2 seconds later, they get closer to the judge. They realize it's not me. And then they get all confused and look around to realize I'm on the other side of the ring. Now, it is something that we have to try and train. It's not very easy when you train on your own to do that. You do have to. And I find it's worse with my young dog. So Pac-Man, my young collie, I was actually right by him when a judge accelerated. She was on the far side of the dog walk, which is a perfect position. And then I think she'd been so busy watching, which does happen sometimes, she suddenly realized she wasn't in position for the next bit. And she suddenly ran around the dog walk and across by the A-frame. And it was just one of those freak things. And he caught the movement in the peripheral of his eye, of his vision. And he turned away from me because typically the person moving the most is the handler. And I lost him up an A-frame. And he got all the way over to the judge. And then he was like, I don't know you. Who are you? Oh. And then he realised I was still back where he'd left me. And he kept trying back over. Oh, I love it. They try so hard. But yeah, judges maintaining a specific pace is definitely helpful. And it's surprising because it does affect running dogs as well. I often see running dogs will push a bit wider if a judge has suddenly accelerated near them. And then the handlers afterwards are like, why did you do that? And I'm like, well, actually, that was the moment that the judge accelerated right towards you. Their movement pushed your dog wide.
Oh.
But because the handler is so close, it has less of an effect because they push wide. And in that split second, they realize that it wasn't mum or it wasn't dad. So then they pull back into their handler.
Interesting. Do you know what? I'm going to be going back now and looking at my videos when I've had my like faults and knees this year, just to see if or even my clears, just to see if there is that that behavior there, as you say. And it's really interesting because at the end of the day, you know, some breeds as well, I'm guessing, and some dogs are more predisposed to want to chase something like a sudden movement, especially like when you think of our collie types who are bred to herd. Their eyes are going to be so quick on any sort of sudden movement. It makes complete sense, and that's a really good point actually for judges. I think that's a really nice thing to sort of take away from it, is having that smooth movement or being consistent, as you say.
Yeah. So the other bit is judges. If there's a previous class that's on the same course, say you've got champ, large and intermediate typically will run same ring, same course. I know it happens at other grades, but I'll just talk from the point of champ for a minute. If large runs first, obviously my champ dog at the moment is my intermediate dog, and I've noticed where the judge is standing, I'll have that in my head when I then go and walk the course. Then, if there's a potential collision zone or a conflict of interest zone, I'll give the judge a heads up. Like, just so you know, I've seen where you've been judging from. I am actually planning to handle it from around that point, obviously, if it all goes to plan. Yeah. And most judges are really grateful for the heads up. Now, that doesn't mean that they're going to change where they judge from What it means is they will be more spatially aware that I'm in their space, and they may even have thought about it beforehand, rather than in that 5 seconds when I walk out from a start line and I'm suddenly standing on their toes and they've got to think on the spot. It's a bit harder for them. So I try and give people a heads up if I can. But that this is where it you then have to be, well, kind of thinking on the moment. If it all goes wrong and you end up in the path of the dog, stand still, because that will help the dog find the right pair of legs again.
Yeah.
If you end up in the handler's path, if possible, just step backwards. If you can see that you're on their trajectory, step backwards if possible. But if all else fails, don't dodge us. Stand still. We will go around you, because we're all used to doing it already.
Yeah.
So it's one of those, like when you try and go past someone in a supermarket, if you both try and dodge, you both go the wrong way.
Yeah, absolutely.
Stand still. We will dodge you, because we've been doing it for years. And a lot of distancers will say the same. They're very used to dodging judges.
Yeah. No, I think that's a really good point, actually. And I know as a judge myself, I would really appreciate if someone, as you say, was going to come in, do distance handling, and they noticed that I was going to be in their path. And even, I guess, you know, before a class, because if a distance handler wanted to ask me what my intended path was, to say if it was the first class of the day, I'd be more than happy to point that out to them, and just to give, you know, give that kind of give and take, really, isn't it, you know, supporting each other. I think that'd be, I'd be more than willing to do that myself.
Yeah, and I think that that's really lovely. And it's that fine line. Most people distance for a reason. It's normally health related. And we don't want to ask for preferential or special treatment. We want to be treated the same as everybody else. At the same time, you have the flip side of, yes, but I still don't want to fall over a judge. Yeah. And some of the judges, I'm quite lucky nowadays. I've nearly always got some kind of brightly coloured hair. Most people now that judge at champ level recognise when crazy lady walks in the ring with bright hair, something's going to be different. And I've had a few judges, so Phil Barber, he's fabulous, Paul Hinchley. There was another judge, bless him, I can't remember his name. He judged me only about a month ago. And after the morning round, he twigged. And when I went in the ring for my next round, he was like, am I going to be in your way here? I'll move further over. Paul Hinchley and Neil Ellis have both seen me come in a ring and gone, hang on. And they've swapped to judging on the outside of a contact instead of on the inside of a contact, on the assumption that I will handle from the inside of the ring and not on the edge, because I would typically aim to handle from midpoint, because then everything is equal distance.
Yeah.
So there are some judges out there, take my hat off to them. It is so appreciated if it's a complicated course and they realise they're out of the way of a runner, but they've seen how I work and I'm going to be in the middle, and they take it on their own head. And that means more than people will ever realise. You know, we don't want special treatment, but at the same time, that tiny little gesture of kindness is so appreciative. You know, if I haven't got to worry about falling over a judge or trying to get my dog round a jump where there's 4 or 5 jumps very tight together and the judges stood quite nearby, and it's, you know what, it's appreciated. Thank you.
Absolutely. I think, as you say, we can all be mindful of everyone at the end of the day. You know, it's just about making sure everyone has that equal. It's not about being preferential. It's about being equal, really, isn't it?
Yeah, yeah. And it is. I mean, you always get the odd judge that can be a little on the grumpy side. Normally there's someone that's never judged me before and they're a little bit taken aback by the positions I'm in. There's been a few choice words said at different points between myself and judges. Not bad or nasty, but they're in shock and then they don't quite know what to do and then they get in the way. And then I think, to be fair, they get quite defensive because I don't think they mean to be in the way, but they don't know what to do. They don't know how to deal with the situation. So I do think in some ways there could be a little bit more education on actually how a judge can influence a dog and a handler from in the ring, because the judges course, they focus a little bit on course design, a little bit on layout. They mostly focus on the actual judging, but what they don't necessarily take into account is the human factor.
Yeah, absolutely. I've had a few close calls myself, and as you say, it's just about knowing how to do it in the moment and how to manage it in the moment. And I think your advice there is spot on. It's really helpful for a judge who doesn't do distance handling. That's been really insightful in knowing how I can support other distance handlers.
Cool. I'm glad it's helpful.
Yeah, absolutely. Awesome. Have you got anything else you want to add to that one, or do you want me to give you the final question? It's a big one, though.
Yeah, I think that's pretty much it on the judging. So yeah, let's move on to the next one.
Awesome. Okay. So, final question. So this was sent in. So I'm constantly hearing people tell me that because they can't run, they can't do these, in quotation marks, big European type courses. But your recent results and prior show that you can indeed be a strong contender at the top level whilst using distance skills. How do you think we can best encourage anyone who doesn't think they can run to carry on doing agility and embrace these kinds of courses, which I think are better for our dogs?
I think this is such a fabulous question. I've seen so many people, particularly through COVID and shortly after, certainly the first year after COVID, that gave up. They got unfit during COVID. Agility maybe kept them going. And then they didn't have the will or the physical ability anymore to keep going. Personally, my response, look, the size of the course doesn't matter. Only the size of the determination of the handler. Okay.
Yeah.
In some cases, the international style, of course, can be easier for distance because the lines for the dog are very specific. They're almost predetermined. Now, I truly believe that absolutely anything is possible, but only if you're willing to put the work in. And it's got to be the right kind of work. Most people think distance handling is just teaching a dog to drive on. But surprisingly, the last thing I teach my dog to do is drive. Because what's the point in driving a dog across an entire ring if you can't steer them when they get there?
Yeah.
People are always surprised. They come on a workshop and, okay, I can't teach you full distance in an hour and a half or 2 hours. But most people expect me to just teach go. And I'm like, I talk to a lot of people online. I talk to a lot of people at shows. And it's really great to inspire people to continue with their hobby. Agility is for fun. And it does mean that you should enjoy it no matter what. But I do also understand how demoralizing it can be to not be able to get around a course. So I think showing people that there are different ways to do things, joking about the fact that, hey, it's the dog that's timed, not the human. You know, we often hear jokes about whether or not there's oxygen on offer at the end of a big course. But again, it's the dog that's got to do the obstacles and run around the ring. And it's so, so easy to do a course without running yourself. If nothing else, as a handler, take it on as a challenge. Maybe don't come back to competing yet. Maybe go training. Maybe get your love back for just enjoying the sport instead of focusing on the competing. I'm not saying don't compete, but then maybe find a new challenge. If your challenge is not the competition because you feel the courses are too hard, you feel the courses are too big, your challenge could be, you know what, I'm going to do this course and I'm only going to allow myself to jog for 10 steps. The rest of the course I've got to walk. So give yourself a personal challenge. Look, anyone can do it. I mean, I've just been away at the Paragility World Champs and there's people in wheelchairs. In fact, there was a new lady this year and I've got to talk about her. She was absolutely incredible. She was working a beautiful black Labrador and she was in a wheelchair. She has a soundboard on her lap and she doesn't talk. So her dog's cues are buttons on the soundboard that make different rhythmic sounds. And she has one for forwards, she has one for the weaves, one for the tunnel. I don't think she has a left and a right, but I don't think she would physically be able to give the sound buttons quickly enough. And you know what? If that lady, who probably getting out of bed is the hardest thing she does in the day, if that lady can go in a ring and show people the amazing relationship she has with her dog, then maybe the rest of us can stop moaning and try it as well.
Wow, that is incredible. And not only that, but to actually, you know, get up, go, you know, go against all the kind of things she'll have in the day, but also train her dogs to do that is just, that is phenomenal.
Yeah. And I think the biggest way to inspire people is make it a challenge. Don't go, well, of course you can, or, well, you might as well give up then. Give them a challenge. Well, can you do 3 jumps and you're only allowed to jog for 2 steps? Can you put your dog in a tunnel with your arms folded? You know, silly things. Make it fun. Inspire people to find the challenge in training their dog, because dog agility is just trick training. It's no different to a sit, to a down, to a spin, to a weave, to a dog walk, to a heel, to a leg weave. It's the same thing. It's just tricks.
Mm, absolutely. And I think as well, as you say, it's more what this person's goals are. You know, if you're always going to be looking at the outcome goals, you're never going to have that sense of satisfaction. Whereas if you're looking at the process, as you say, looking at, you know, those steps, can I teach my dog to go in the tunnel with my arms across? You're going to have much more satisfaction from it. And I think mindset could be a huge factor in that one.
Yeah, I think mindset is huge. I've always been one of those people is like, if you tell me I can't do it, I will do it just to prove you wrong. And I know a lot of people like that. And you know what? Honestly, we're all just completely nuts. That's really what it boils down to. But sometimes, instead of encouraging someone, challenge them. That can be the best thing. With the course design, so the European style courses or the international style, of course, they are very popular at the moment. They are quite different to maybe what we used to be used to. And I would describe them for the most part as being a single predetermined track for the dogs. So in some ways they flow much better. There is a more obvious path to the next correct obstacle for the dogs, thus making them appear easier. But don't get me wrong, I love the international courses. Earlier in the year, we got the chance to run some Stephanie Semcat courses. And I loved that. Some of the hardest bits on that course, the runners politely were keeling over out of breath on. And actually some of the hardest bits we nailed first time. But we couldn't do the bits that the runners found easy. You know, so it's pros and cons.
Yeah.
With the international courses, it's almost very robotic almost. So the dog, if you watch an international style, of course, there's some brilliant ones online that you can look at, and if you watch a video of that course plan running, every single dog will run the exact same course, and it's very monotonous, very stereotypical, and very robotic. And I remember the days when a competition could be won or lost on a single decision. Do I turn left or do I turn right? And 0.1, 0.2 of a second. But that's the difference between winning and coming 10th sometimes. And the only thing I dislike about the international courses, I don't mind the size. I don't mind the design. They're absolutely fantastic fun to run. But there's no choice. The choice is the handler. The handler, do I do a blind? Do I do a front cross? Do I do a rear cross? But the dog doesn't change. Well, that makes them easier for me, you know, but it doesn't necessarily make it more of a challenge. The biggest challenge with the international style courses is the ability to layer. As long as you can layer, you don't need to run most of the course plans that I look at online. Obviously, we have nowhere to set them up. I'm working on that, and I would love to have somewhere to set them up. But most of the course plans I look at, I'll walk the course around in my head, and I'm talking about like the grade 6-7
end.
And I'm like, it's basically a straight line. It's basically a circle, straight lines and circles with very few technical skills. And predominantly you can handle from any single point in any of those courses. Like you don't even have to travel that much. You've got to pick the right point to handle from. And then you can basically handle a course with very little movement. So personally, I love those courses because the handlers get 2/3 of the way around. They need oxygen and they can't get their cues out anymore and they're out of breath. And I just kind of saunter down the side towards the finish and be like, come on, let's finish. And, you know, hell, they make my life easier. So I actually think if you can't run, they're easier. I know the style design is this original question person believes they're better for the dogs. And in some ways, I would agree. They are smoother flowing lines. it's not constantly round the back, round the back, round the back, round the back, twist, 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 kill your back, kill your back, kill your back, kill your legs.
Yeah.
You know, which is fantastic from our dog's health point of view. But I do miss the challenges of different things. And we see trends. Oh, we see trends in low-grade courses at the minute. So many judges are putting in a random round the back just so they can straighten a dog up for a contact. When
actually, yeah,
it's just, if they just went straight onto the contact, it'd be so much better. But no, no, no. It's the trend at the moment. So we're all putting in a random jump to the side to do a backside wrap. Very neat and tidy if you're a running handler. Onto contacts. I hate things like that. I can do them. My dogs can do them. My students can do them. But there's no joy in it. Let's randomly add in a full 360 on a jump. Woo, that was fun. The international stuff doesn't have that as much. It lets the dogs run. It lets the dogs stretch. So if you've taught your dog to run and to stretch, you ain't got hope in hell of getting near them unless you're an Olympic sprinter.
Yeah, absolutely. And like you say, I think for a distance handler, it sounds like, you know, these European courses are actually more beneficial, especially if there's that layering element, which I guess is a big factor in when it comes to distance and, you know, the dog layering and moving away from you. It must lend you, and as you say, it must lend you a lot in your lungs as well, because it saves you all the hassle of trying to sprint to get places and whatnot. So that's really interesting, actually.
Yeah, it's although, as comical as this may sound, I will often come out of a high grade class, so a champ, a grade 6-7, or the international stuff that we do, more out of breath than a runner.
Really?
Yeah, but that's a health thing. That's got nothing to do with the actual course. But yeah, it's quite entertaining. Sometimes I come out and people are like, "God, you weren't even running," and I'm like, "Yeah, give me a minute."
Mine's always when I watch back and I think, "God, I really was like Usain Bolt in that one." And I watch my run and I'm barely making out of a jog, if I'm honest. Oh wow! Well, I must say thank you so much, because I've learned so much in this one, and from, you know, a judge's perspective, a competitor, a trainer, it's been fascinating. I'm really excited to share this one. So just to close as well, obviously you've mentioned about your online training and new books and everything, but can you tell everyone where we can find that and, you know, all the kind of different things that you do?
Yeah, okay. So I do have a book. It's called Handling the Distance Without Spilling Your Coffee. It's quite a comical front cover, actually. And I will say, I have students that take it as a personal challenge, and I get sent videos of them sitting on a chair with a cup of coffee or something in one hand, or a beer half the time, and them working their dog around it. And I love that. So yeah. I've got the book. It's predominantly made up with photos and diagrams. It does have written explanations as well, but it's actually very accessible. We have people with different health disabilities. I'm just trying to be careful to say the right things here. And I've had emails telling me that they were really worried about having it because they're not good with books and they're not good with reading, and or they're dyslexic and this, that and the other. And actually they found the book very easy to understand, very simple and very easy to follow. So I'm very, very proud of my book, and it's in pretty much every country around the world nowadays.
Amazing.
Yeah, it's been on sale since 2020, I think.
Wow. That is amazing that it's international as well. Congrats.
Thank you. I have my online training, so it's tamingcanines.co.uk. And There's lots of different options. So there's 10 different online courses. But the best package to go for, there's obviously different sign-up options, but we do the complete package. And with the complete, you can upload your videos and you get all your feedback on your videos. Your videos don't have to be of things on the website. If you go to a show and you come across something, you send it in. We have a support group where we talk, we do questions. I will go and train. So at the minute I've got an 11-month-old cocker. And if I go and do something in the garden with him, I'll post that in the group, and you guys get to ask questions on what I'm doing and see what I'm doing, and see when things go wrong, how I deal with, okay, well, I was coming out to train this. This happened, so I'm now totally changing and training this. So that's in there. I've got puppy diaries on the site for the Dalmatian and one of the Spaniel crosses. So two different, very different types of dog.
Yeah.
On there. And again, we just cover so many topics, and I'm always adding to it. For me, the library will never be complete, but it is geared towards distance training, obviously. Saying that, I do train runners as well, and I always joke and say running is not a dirty word. It's okay to run. But I do, and the system works for anyone, whether you want to run with your dog, walk with your dog, sit in a chair, use a mobility scooter, it doesn't matter. I was a lovely young girl on Wednesday this week who I'd never met before, and we did a hooper session and an agility session, and she was in a wheelchair, and she said she'd been told, "Oh, you can't do agility, you're in a wheelchair, don't be silly." And I was horrified. And it's taken her a long time to actually come to an agility session. And I'm so glad she did. Her little spaniel was lovely. And I just think, you know what? Just because you can't teach someone how to do something, you don't stop them from doing it. Anyone can do it.
Absolutely.
Surprisingly, I do have quite a lot of runners come to me. They want their dog to be more independent, less Velcro. They don't want distance as such.
Yeah.
If you do the system online, the system in the book, it's all the same system. For roughly 8 weeks, you can then go back to running and put your own system back in, but your dog's value and independence will be a lot greater, and it only takes 6-8 weeks.
Wow, that is fascinating. I think something I'll have to actually look into, because my young dog's very, very well, she's the one that was crying to come into the room with us, so yeah, she's quite the character, wants to be with me. So yeah, no, that is fantastic. And as you say as well, that point about that young lady with the wheelchair, how unfair it is that someone, you know, deems that even though they can't do it, no one else can teach them. And it's just so wrong, isn't it? And I think it's really important to be inclusive, as you say. And it's amazing how inclusive your book is, by the sounds of it as well. So big congratulations for that as well.
Thank you. I'm very, very proud. I'm very, very lucky. I've got an amazing wife that supports everything I do. She doesn't do dog agility. She doesn't have a clue about it, to be honest. But she's so supportive. And she's at home dog sitting whoever isn't on the road with me. I'm very, very lucky with our dogs. We have amazing dogs, and I honestly wouldn't be where I am without them. I mean, the Kelpie basically trained me, and the Collie started me off. And the Kelpie finished my training, and then the others, now I train them, but they trained me. Oh. You know, you can't do it without a good dog. Agility is not about the handler. You've got to have a dog, and you've got to have a damn good relationship with that dog if you want to get anywhere. Relationship wins over anything.
Absolutely. And like I said, I'm guessing with distance as well, that trust, the dog to have that trust in you to guide them and whatnot.
Oh, absolutely. Super quick, funny story for you. my young collie, Mr. Pac-Man, who I adore the pants off, but I have been pulling my hair out with him on an agility front. He's incredible. He's amazing. But we've been hitting a few brick walls, shall we say. And I decided to change what I was doing, because I do typically baby them when they first come out. I try and move a little bit more and be a little bit closer, because you do. And even though I do distance, I'm still self-conscious at shows, because if it goes wrong and you're standing still, you look like a real plonker. And at least if it looks like you're making an effort, when it goes wrong, you don't look as much of a plonker. But he doesn't like that. And I decided to give myself a kick at the backside on Saturday night at the show earlier this year. And I was like, come on, big girl pants on tomorrow, just do it how you do it in training. So I did, and we got to obstacle number 5 or whatever it was, and we hadn't been eliminated yet, and nothing had gone wrong yet, and I was celebrating at obstacle number 5.
Oh,
how bad it has been. And I gave him his go-go. Now, go-go is my forward drive cue. I don't use it very often. It's very rare you'll hear me say go or go on or anything around the ring. I don't have to drive my dogs forwards. But in this instance, I had a really long sweeping line of jumps.
Mm-hmm.
So I said, go, go. And he go-goed. And I was so busy standing there going, look, it's working. He's amazing. I completely forgot to say right. And he continued through the next ring as well.
Oh, God.
His go-go was so good. He go-goed, and there was not a dog running at the time, I will say. And as soon as he went under the rope and started doing the kit in the adjacent ring, my brain kicked in and went, oh, hang on, turn right, come back. And to be fair to the judge, she found it hilarious because she twigged that the moment I said right, he turned right and he came back into our ring. He wasn't being naughty. But oh my God, it was the funniest thing I think I've ever seen. I was just so thrilled that for once we were getting it right, I forgot to say anything and just watched him disappear.
What a good dog. Oh my God, bless him. That is, but like I said, he put a lot of trust in you, and he was like, "Yep, sure, Mum, I'm going to trust that you want me to go into this ring. I'll go for it."
Oh my God, bless him! He's such a good boy. I was just so surprised. And he's been a very, very hard dog. He was a COVID puppy, and then he had a shoulder op of 15 months. Oh. So he was very late starting. He'll be four at the end of this month, but he's more like a 2-year-old, like just a 2-year-old. So maybe in another couple of years, we'll actually have a little bit more steering skills in the ring, I think, to go with. But it's the only problem when you teach your cues really, really well. If you forget to say them or you say the wrong one, it does not work in your favour.
Oh, bless him. Oh, well, I must say, thank you so much for your time today, because these questions have been amazing, and your answers have been phenomenal and so helpful. And absolutely, I'll leave some links as well in the show notes, so if anyone wants to find you, your online training and your book, they can find it there.
Yeah, well, thanks for having me on. I'm up for anything, and if it helps people or it inspires them to try something new, then fantastic, you know.
Oh God, yeah,
great to be on. Take care.
Thank you.